Welcome to Saturday Night at the Movies, the podcast that celebrates classic, cult, and current films and the people that made them and many other aspects of pop culture. I'm your host, Steve Rubin. Our producer is Ben Shrewsbury, and our signature theme was composed by Greg Lehrhoff. Here it's always Saturday night, and our mission is to chronicle film and pop cultural history one memory at a time. Tonight, we welcome writer-producer Matt Redd, coming to us all the way from Wales, UK. Matt wrote the thriller Tollbooth, which you can easily find these days in the streaming verse. As I mentioned in my Facebook review, it's a tidy thriller with a very colorful cast of characters and a very compelling story. When Matt contacted me to thank me for the review, I immediately invited him to come on Saturday Night at the Movies. And here we are. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you, Steve. Nice to be here.
You know, I, as the listeners and viewers know, that I kind of start, I'll start all my interviews by talking about when you were a kid and you were first exposed to movies. And I usually ask the question, were you a movie-going family when you were little?
We did used to go to the cinema, maybe not so much as a family, but we would go, like my dad would take me to the cinema when I was small, and then I definitely have memories of my mum taking me up with groups of friends and stuff like that when we were very small. There was a cinema in Haverford West, which is the town that I grew up in, a small town, like 10,000 people.
What was the name of the town?
The town's called Haverford West.
Haverford West. Now, is that in Wales?
Yes, that's on the sort of west coast of Wales, yeah, in Pembrokeshire, the county of Pembrokeshire, where the film is set.
Got it.
So there was a cinema there called the Palace Cinema, which was very run down. But I thought it was kind of like a great place to go. So we would go there. I remember seeing The Never Ending Story, and I must have been very young seeing that there. And I remember seeing things like Home Alone, Santa Claus the movie, like stuff like that when I was very small. So we do that, and then also just like growing up, so less as a family and just growing up then with friends, because growing up in a small town on the coast where the weather's pretty bad a lot of the time, going to the cinema was a bit of an escape of something to do, really. So all through my sort of childhood and teenage years, we'd go and see everything that came out. Basically, we'd go to the cinema to see it.
So how early were you getting into creative writing? Were you doing it in school?
No, I didn't do any of it in school. I didn't. I studied film at university in Aberystwyth, which is a town a bit further up the coast from Haverford West in Pembrokeshire, just up in a county called Ceredigion, right on the coast as well. And again, another small town, maybe like 10,000 people, but also about 10,000 university students as well. And I studied film there, and I did do a module in writing there, but I didn't really pursue it again for like another 10 years or something like that. It was just something I was kind of interested in, but I just never thought it was like a viable thing to do, maybe, if that makes sense.
What were you pursuing as a viable thing at that time?
Music. I did a lot of music. I was really into punk rock. I still am into punk rock. So I was playing in bands and like going on tour and did all that for a few years. And then I in my sort of mid-20s, then I think from that, it was a case of, oh, I can't really make a living doing it. I'm having a lot of fun, but I can't make a living doing this. And I ended up going back to university and studied a master's in film producing.
Oh.
So I did that. And then like a couple of years after that, I did a bit of work. I started working in TV and film production. But then I sort of always had this nagging thing in the back of my mind about writing, you know, and I wanting to write. And I'd read lots of screenwriting books. I'd read loads of scripts over the years, like loads and loads. And I was really into it. And I kind of wanted to work in development initially, I think. But then figured, oh, no, I want to give this a try. So I did end up, you know, getting into writing sort of that way. So that was probably like about 10 years after going to university originally. And then I was working in TV production on a lot of the sort of big drama shows that are produced in Wales, things like Doctor Who, stuff like that. Just did a bit of work on that and a few other shows as well. And then while I was doing that, I was writing in my own free time and trying to sort of work out if I was any good at it, really, I think.
Well, judging from Toll Booth, I think you're pretty good at
That's very kind, Steve.
it.
I'll take that. Thank you.
For the listeners and viewers who have not seen this movie, it's just a real interesting ride. And what's amazing about the thriller genre, we have them in all kinds. There's the big, huge thrillers, like a movie like Heat with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. And then there's the little smaller thrillers like Toll Booth. And tell us a little bit how Toll Booth came about. Was that an original screenplay that you created on your own completely?
Well, no, I worked with the director, Ryan Andrew Hooper, who directed it. It's quite a sort of long, convoluted story, but I guess the briefest month of the film is as well, but the actual making of it is too. But I'll try and keep it as brief as I can. But we'd sort of decided that I'd met Ryan. We were working in both in like production jobs, really. But he wanted to direct, and I wanted to write, and so we sort of joined forces in that sense, and I said to him, I'll write a script, you'll direct it, we'll work out how to raise the money. And the original plan was to just shoot it for as little as possible, just get whatever cash together we could and shoot it. And then it went through various iterations of the story and all of that, and we ended up, there's a in Wales, we're really lucky, there's an organization called Film Cymru, which is sort of like a public body really that finances the Welsh film industry really, and invests money in both sort of projects like films, but also in talent, in helping people develop their skills and all of that. So we were very lucky that they ended up giving us a tiny bit of money to develop the script. And then they also gave us some money with the BFI as well, the British Film Institute, who fund, again, like publicly fund film in Britain. And they gave us some money to make a short. So we ended up making a short, which was sort of the proof of concept for the film, which was, it was called Ambition, and it had a different actor playing the lead role, but it had the same actor playing the triplets as well, too, that appeared. And it the scene, the focus of the short was very similar to the feature in terms of there was a robbery at like a toll booth. It was a bit more sort of like weird and David Lynchian or something, really. But we did that, and then from that we were very fortunate in that we were able to raise the finance to then shoot the film, the feature film, based off the script that I'd then written for the feature and the proof of concept for the short as well.
How long was the short?
Running time, I think it may be about 10 or 15 minutes, maybe.
Seems to be, and I'm also a screenwriter. I find today that more and more people don't want to read, they want to see. And proof of concept seem to be a very viable way of taking a project to the next step. I guess, especially when you're trying to raise money.
Yeah, and I think especially if you've got a first-time director, because it's so difficult for first-time directors just to get a shot at shooting a film, really. So I think it was really important that we could prove to the people with the money that Ryan could shoot this sort of single location type thing in an interesting way. And our gimmick really for it was having this one actor playing these three characters robbing this toll booth, essentially. So I think that was a way to show that Ryan had some sort of, directorial flair and ability, I guess.
So you're talking about Gwyneth, and I unfortunately I cut her head off.
This year. This year.
It's funny because when I watched Toll Booth, I was looking at the girls and I said, God, they look like triplets. And it's just Gwyneth playing all three roles. That's pretty clever, actually. Kind
Yeah,
of.
I guess that was the plan from the beginning. So we actually went to meet Gwyneth after I'd written the short. We sent Gwyneth the script for the short, and she's like pretty much my favorite actor, So I was just really wanted to work with her. So we'd sent her this short. We went to have a drink with her. We went up to London to meet her where she was living, I think still lives, And so we said, oh, this is how we want to do it. We at the time we didn't even have the money to make the shorts, but we just really wanted her involved. So we wanted to say to the people with the money, we've got this actor who wants to do it, and we think she's great. We know she's great because she's, already shot some really good stuff. And this is how we want to do it. And so that was, I think, really helpful when it came to getting that money together, was having an actor on board already that in Wales in particular is, very, very much like a well-loved performer.
Are you at liberty to say what the budget of the feature was?
I think so, yeah. I don't think anyone's ever told me I'm not allowed to, but it was shot for, I guess, US dollars, probably maybe $500,000.
Wow, that's very impressive. That's very impressive. But it's the way things are done for newbies these days. Nobody's going to hand you $10 million to make a movie.
No.
So I'm very impressed. Now you said that Michael Smiley, who plays Tollbooth, the leading character, was not in the short. Can you talk a little bit about, because he's so perfect in the role. Let me just pull up a little picture of him here. Here we go. There he is. And talk a little bit. Tell me a little bit how the story came together. I mean, he's. By the way, I think I may even have mentioned in my review that it reminded me a little bit of the classic film noir film, The Killers, where Burt Lan I don't know if you know The Killers, Burt Lancaster, the first, he's on the run from the trouble he got into, and he's working in a filling station when these killers come to get him. And it just kind of then it flashes back to his life. But this idea that he's kind of a mobster who's left the mob and gotten away. He's been gone like 20 years, something like that. And he lived.
Something like, yeah, something like, I can't actually remember how long it is, but it was about 20 years, yeah.
So in your story, was he always running a toll booth?
Yes, so that was the thing. So what we sort of thought initially was, in order to make a film on that sort of money, we would just limit the locations, and as you see with like horror and stuff, particularly you get these single location thrillers or whatever, we thought, well, let's just do that. So we thought, right, well, let's try and what's a really like unusual setting that hasn't been done before. And I don't know if you remember that the opening credits of the film, there is a toll booth on a bridge, like a big working toll booth, and that toll booth actually isn't there anymore. It was sort of got rid of just after we shot the film. But that when I was very small in school, a boy I was in school with, his dad worked on that toll booth, and I think maybe he worked the night shift on that toll booth or something. And I remember just thinking, like, that must be very, very quiet because it's on a bridge in remote part of West Wales with very little traffic, so. And so that just sort of stuck with me, that this bridge was always there. And then also, for again, it's gone now, but for a long, long time, many years, there was a toll booth at the entrance to Wales from England in the south. So it was very much like an iconic sort of like Welsh thing, was you have to pay the toll booth to get into Wales. That was kind of something we've all done for many, many years. But again, it's recently been taken away.
Just out of curiosity, in those days, what did it cost to enter Wales from the UK?
Oh, do you know? I can't remember how much, but not a lot. But the one down in the west, like when I was small, it was literally pennies, like it is in the film. It almost felt like not worth, well, not worth paying. The money they would have had to spend to pay someone to sit there, maybe wasn't even worth it. But we are literally talking just a few pennies, and even to get in then to Wales from England, it was. I can't remember, maybe a couple of pounds or something, like it was like a not like a huge amount of money at all. But there was some company, I think this is a long aside, but I think the company who owned the toll booth or something was a Spanish company. So they were just taking all this money. And I think eventually the contract was up or something, and the government was like, right, let's get rid of it.
So as his character, I mean, obviously he wants to get as far away from his previous life. So I guess this toll booth in rural, remote Wales is probably literally the last place he figures anybody would be looking for him. But in the course of dramatic storytelling, the unfortunate thing happens that he does get spotted.
Yeah, that and that was it, and that was you sort of have to have that I guess the inciting incident or whatever, of the story, and that was the sort of unfortunate coincidence for him, was that in all the places that he could have been, this was the one place that eventually they found him.
Let me get out of her way. As good as Michael Smiley is as Tollbooth, I thought that Annis Elwy, is that a way you pronounce it? Annis
Yeah,
Annis
Anis,
El
yeah.
as Katrin, the cop, she's great. It's funny. She's so good. I kept on saying to myself, who is that? And how did you come by how did you find Annis?
She was someone who we had a very, very short list, of people we were looking for, because what we wanted was a young female actor who was a fluent Welsh speaker and who was sort of, there's lots of good ones around actually, but we were just looking to see who might be available, and our casting director put together a really short list, and straight away she was at the top of the list. So we sent the script to her. And we didn't send it to anybody else from memory. It went to Annis, and Annis read it. And I think she might have taped some stuff for Ryan, but apart from that, she was in. And then coincidentally, it turned out that she lived on the next street to me. So we ended up we just the two, three of us just went to the local pub and made a chat about making the film, and she was on board. It was weirdly that simple.
Did you find Michael in the same way?
No, so that the original plan was that the actor who was played Tollbooth in the short would play him in the feature as well, and that was Simon Russell Beale, so who's like a really like celebrated actor, especially on the stage here in England, and Simon wasn't able to do it essentially, so we had to rethink what we wanted to do, and that was really tricky actually. So I don't think we actually cast Michael until not long before we actually shot. Like I think it
Oh.
was during prep we ended up casting Michael, and it was just really tricky to work out who would be the right person to play that role, because I think particularly for me, because I'd written the feature having made the short, so I had this vision in my head of who this man was, and Michael's very, very different to Simon. But then when we, obviously Michael is fantastic. So when Michael's name was sort of put up by the casting director, it was a case of actually he would be brilliant, and it just meant like a few tweaks, because he's Irish and Simon is very, very much English. So it's just a slight reimagining of who that man might be. But ultimately, only cosmetic changes in terms of how the dialogue would be delivered and all of that stuff, really.
Where is Michael known for? What shows is Michael known for in your neck of the woods?
Well, he's done quite a few films with the director Ben Wheatley.
Oh,
So
sure.
if you look up any of Ben's films, like he's done a few of those, and he was also in a really popular detective or cop show with Idris Elba called Luther.
Oh, of course,
But
of course.
and he's also been, I think, in a few of the Simon Pegg, Edgar Wright movies as well. So he's got like a long list of films he's done, like particularly like a lot of British indie movies.
How long was your shooting schedules?
It was 18 days. We shot it all in 18 days in the November in horrendous weather.
Now, knowing that that time of year could be turbulent, and any particular reason why you chose that time of year?
I think we probably chose that initially just because we had the money in place, and so it was a case of we need to just pick a date and go for it. But what turned, I can't remember if this was the plan or whether this just turned out to be the way, but what we discovered was in November, a lot of actors aren't working, so it's not the sort of peak time for drama production really at all, because most stuff shoots over the sort of spring and summer. And then early autumn, I guess, really period. You've got a few shows that shoot year round and stuff, but lots of sort of not going on in November. So we had access to actors who perhaps ordinarily we wouldn't have access to just because we were shooting kind of out of season, if that makes sense.
Sure. Well, these kinds of thrillers really depend a lot on the supporting casts and faces as well. I mean, you have a lot of interesting people in your movie. These two guys, is it pronounced Iwan on the right? Is it Iwan or how do you?
Iwan.
Iwan. Iwan
Iwan, yeah.
Rayon. Iwan Rayon. And
Iwan
then
Rayan, yeah.
Paul Kay on the left, I believe.
Yeah.
Even though their role isn't huge, every time they come on screen, they're very very interesting characters. Were they friends or again, actors you just found?
No, well, so Iwan is really well known here. Like he was in Game of Thrones. He had like a big part in Game of Thrones. He was
Oh, of
Ramsay
course,
Bolton.
that's why I recognize. He's the one that they mutilate.
So he's and Paul, funny enough, Paul was in Game of Thrones as well. But a few of our cast, Gwyneth was, I think, I think maybe four cast who were in Game of Thrones. But yeah, so Iwan is like a one of sort of Wales's like hottest, stars really, I guess. And so for us it was, we were really keen to get the script to him to see if he would do it. But I didn't know him. We did have mutual friends, but I didn't know him at the time. And Paul is just someone who I've been a huge fan of since I was really small. Like before he was an actor, or at least appearing in lots of drama and stuff, he used to play a character called Dennis Pennis. I don't know if he ever made it to the US, but he would do something that in the age of TikTok and all that Instagram and stuff now is quite common, but I guess. But he would prank actors on the red carpet, and he would do it. And this is back in the sort of like 90s, I guess, where he would turn up on the red carpet and he would ask like inappropriate but hilarious questions to, I think it was Demi Moore and Tom Hanks and all sorts of people. And he became a TV star in the 90s from doing that. And then he went on to create other characters in comedy and then act in loads of stuff, including feature films as the lead and stuff, but also like loads of supporting parts. And he's had a huge career. So when we sent the script to him, I think he might have been one of the first people to say yes. And I think that was really good for us in the sense that because Paul was willing to do it and his name was on it quite early in the casting process in that sense, I think it gave a vote of confidence to other cast as well to think, well, if Paul Kay is going to do it, and he also is a lovely man, so I imagine he's got like a really good reputation among actors. But I think people thought because Paul's doing it, then it's that endorsement that we'll do it as well. And I think the cast sort of came together a lot off the back of that. And I think Iwan also, like, part of the reason he did it, perhaps, I think, was because Michael was doing it too, So I think putting together the ensemble, I think, was really beneficial. That once we got some established names in, other established names just wanted to do it.
Well, it's very empowering when you have your money because you suddenly are more advanced than 12,000 other teams of filmmakers who don't have their money. And boy, more than ever, money talks in this business because nobody else will return your phone call if you say we're in development, which is of course a kind of damning word. So you get your money, you get your cast. Let me pull up the poster again. It's such a cool poster. I like the poster. By the way, I found this on the internet as well. Was there a point at one point where the movie was called simply The Toll?
Well, so it is called The Toll everywhere except for North America.
Oh, okay.
It was originally called The Toll, and then before it was released, it got picked up by a distributor in North America by Samuel Goldwyn. And then before they released it, there's another film called The Toll, which I think is a horror. I haven't seen it. I think it's a horror film which came out maybe a year or two before a Canadian film. And I think because of that, they were concerned that, people wouldn't see this film because of the, the crossover with the title with the other film. So they retitled it Toll Booth then.
So you and Ryan get this film together. It's starting to shoot. How are you feeling about the process? A lot of writers don't come to the set. for various reasons. It sounds like you and Ryan were kind of tied at the hip, so I assume you were there every day.
I was there for every, I missed one day, but I was there for every day. I was there for every day of prep. Yeah, and because my background as well before then was working in production as a as an assistant director. So it was actually sort of useful having someone else around who had that sort of knowledge, I guess, and that skill set, and that I was there on set with a radio and, you know, doing all the things like logistical sort of stuff that a writer would never normally be doing. But because I had that experience of doing that, it was sort of useful to have me because we had such a small crew. You know, with that budget, you know, you can't afford to, you know, have tons and tons of crew. So yeah, so I was like an extra pair of hands and doing some of the sort, I guess, like the logistical and sort of producing side of it as well, really.
How did the weather affect your shoot?
It was really bad. We lost one whole day to rain and we were flooded. We couldn't get to the sets where the toll booth was because of a flood, and we had to claim through our insurance. So thankfully our insurance paid out. So we managed to pick up that day at the end of the shoot. So after the 18th day, we had a day 19 because one of days 6 or 7 or whatever didn't exist, if you know what I mean. So we were able to do that, and mostly it was just, it just made a lot of it hard because it was torrential rain and heavy winds, particularly some of the you don't see it so much on the screen because a lot of the stuff inside the toll booth with Katrin and the toll booth man just chatting, the crew are all outside getting battered by the rain where the two actors are inside the toll booth, and you just wouldn't know that the weather was bad, really.
Did you build the interior of the toll booth on a stage, or was that a practical?
So that's all, it's all real. So none of it is built, you know. So we did actually, for the short film, we built it and shot it on a stage, but the actual feature film, it was a porta cabin that we bought from a kind of like a scrap yard. And then we had them get it on a crane and bring it to a cliff and drop it on on the edge of a cliff. And then we just built, and then the production design, the art department, they were fantastic, and they then dressed the inside of it and put this fake road barrier that did work, like this barrier, but the wheelie, you don't actually see it go up and down at all in the film, but it did actually go up and down because they made it sort of a motorized barrier. But all of that was dressed, and then I think from memory we sold the toll booth back to the people we bought it from at the end of the film.
What would you say was the most, other than the weather, what was the most challenging part of the shoot? Were there any problems that you remember that that were a little bit difficult to solve?
I think there wasn't any sort of like, I think maybe one of the things we did, which was a bit, which caused problems really, was we just had so many vehicles as well. I think we had something like 9 action vehicles, which for a film of this scale is a bit of overkill, you know. So like this, we would have cars or vans or the ambulance, you know, the ambulance, this and it, like it just broke down like all of the time. Because it was such an unreliable vehicle, and so we had our action vehicles guy Johnny, who was a friend of mine, who'd never worked in film before, but he had served for the British Army in like Afghanistan and places, so he was used to like doing stuff under pressure. So Johnny was in charge of all the vehicles, and he would be there. I remember just we'd have the bonnet open of this ambulance, trying to work out how to fix the battery because we needed to get it to the set in 20 minutes and stuff like that. So there's a lot of stress around that, but Johnny was very, very cool under pressure. So, you know, thankfully, even though it was stressful, it always felt like something we were going to overcome.
Terrific, terrific. I noticed, I don't have his picture, but Julian Glover has a nice little role as the mob boss, Magnus. I, of course, know him from Indiana Jones. I know him from James Bond. How did he come to the project?
It was exactly the same as a lot of the cast, really. It was such, for his part particularly, it was so small. We shot him in, I think, 2 days. So it was a case of send him the script and via his agent, you know, and our casting director being a sort of our, you know, working on our behalf, and then sent him the script to see if he was available, and because I guess it was November and he was, and he just said he would do it. It was sort of pretty remarkable, really, the amount of people. I think Simone, our casting director, said quite early, she's just like, she's wonderful, but she was just sort of like, just aim as high as you want. Just if you want them, we'll, what harm can it do? Because she was so well and is so well connected with the agents in the UK. She does loads of films and dramas, and has got a really good reputation. And they would take her calls and they would reply to her emails and stuff like that. So even though we had like very, very little money, we were also very clear about what we were and what we were going to try and do. And we had our dates to shoot. It wasn't a case, like you were saying before, about attaching actors in the development process and all of that sort of stuff. It was a case of, we are filming this in 3 weeks' time, and this is the script. Do you want to do it? And most people said yes, which was pretty amazing, really.
When you have money and a shoot schedule and you say, I need you on Thursday, this is the deal. Actors, they jump at it because they want to work. I had that experience working on a film that's currently on Netflix. It's called My Suicide. It's a teen dramedy. And I'm friendly with Joe Mantegna, the American actor. You know who that is. And we needed Joe to play an Indian psychiatrist on Thursday. And we called him up and he said, sure, I'll come on down, because he hadn't done comedy in a long time. But sometimes it really, the most difficult part I find as a producer is when you don't have the money trying to get people interested in the project because it's not real yet. So unless they know you, the odds are very slim that they'll come on board. So the film, you finish shooting, you go into post. Now, I only know the back end streaming portion of the distribution plan because I saw the movie on one of the distribution, streamers in the US. What was the fate of Toll Booth in your neck of the woods?
Well, we were like lots of filmmakers, really. We were really hit by the COVID outbreak and the effect of that on theatrical. So, we got the film finished, but then it was very tricky in terms of getting it released. We did have a theatrical release during the COVID pandemic, essentially. So it came out in very limited cinemas in the UK, sort of. And then it also had a release theatrically in Australia and New Zealand. The New Zealand one was like fantastically unfortunate in that they'd had no lockdowns, no shutdowns at all across New Zealand for the entire time COVID had happened because of their sort of strict border policy. Our film gets released. 1 week later, they shut the country down and close all the cinemas. So, we thought the one country in the world we might have a good go, so we were really unfortunate, I think, in that we did get a theatrical release in, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, which is great, and it played in a cinema in Australia for ages. Like, I think the Australian distributor said something like it played in an indie cinema in Tasmania or something for something like 4 months or so. Like, it was like the longest time they'd ever had a film screen every week in the cinema or something. But in the end, like, the box office takings were really low, just because there weren't the screens to get the film on. And when it played in Cardiff in the cinema, the Welsh capital, it was still like a situation where you could only allow to sell something like one in every three seats in the screen. So like in a 100, in a small cinema which would hold say 100 people normally, you could now only seat 30 people or
30
something.
people. We
So
had that
yeah.
same problem here in LA. How was the critical reaction to the film? How
Yeah,
did they?
we were really fortunate. Yeah, it was good. It was sort of, everything was positive. We had really lovely review on the BBC film show on the BBC News channel, and decent reviews in like The Guardian and the Sunday Times, and the sort of the press, the mainstream press over here. So yeah, it was like, it nothing was like, it wasn't sort of overly flattering, I guess, but it was just, everyone was just like, oh, this is like a good film, so I think we were really fortunate in that, really.
Did you take the film to London to screen it for the critics there?
No, because it was everything was locked down,
Locked down.
so yeah, so everything was done digitally. Even our sort of world premiere was digitally. It was at Glasgow Film Festival, which is on in Scotland right now, but because of COVID, it was a digital festival only. So the world premiere was, while it was playing, I was just watching it on my TV screen, but via like an app, sat,
Oh, got it. Got it.
on my sofa in the lounge on my own. And we ended up, after the screening, we had a Zoom with loads of the cast and crew, where we all dialed in, and so we had a chat and stuff after the screening, but we never once got to show it in a cinema to the cast and crew, or to critics or anything like that. We didn't have a red carpet or anything, which is a shame, because if it had come out now, at a festival like Glasgow, we would have had all of that stuff.
Got it. Got it. I bet you're happy that COVID was over for anything in the future, as all of us were. Are you and Ryan working on anything new together?
Yeah, we are actually. So I've written another script that is in that stage of casting and raising finance now. So there's another feature we've got, I think, three or four cast attached. We've got a new producer working with us on that as well. So I'm hoping that that will come together over the next year or so. And we're working on a TV show together with another production company as well. So we're doing that together. So we haven't fallen out. We're still friends after that.
Is the new film again a thriller type?
Yeah, it's really similar sort of in tone. If anything, it maybe leans a little bit more into the sort of off the wall comedy that it goes throughout the film. So I think it's a bit more of that, really. But it's a sort of cat and mouse caper, really, like kind of like a chase movie. Yeah.
Does it have a title?
It's called The Life and Death of Daniel D, and Daniel D is the lead character. He's a life insurance salesman who fakes his own death to claim an insurance payout, and he hires a mother and daughter team of fraudsters to help him fake his own death. But it turns out that the mother and daughter team of fraudsters aren't actually fraudsters; they're assassins, and so they kill him for the or try to kill him for the insurance money.
It's that sounds very, very interesting. I work mostly in comedy, and you're working in a much more viable genre these days because nobody seems to want to buy comedy unless it's a big name involved, but we're still rather resolute on that. What do you think? I mean, you're working on the front lines right now. You're out there raising money, you're trying to get films made. How has the world changed in the last 5 years for you in terms of navigating what we see in the States as a rather changing universe?
I think independent film is really tough right now, like really, really tough. And working outside of like the US studio system, like over here, traditionally we've made films by getting what we call soft money, which is the support of organizations like the BFI or Film Cymru or people like that, who've got essentially public money to invest in films. And then you sort of partner that up with foreign sales, essentially, and selling the rights. You're going to the markets at places like Cannes and Berlin, and selling your rights in order to raise the budget to shoot the film. But because the market has sort of fallen out of theatrical, simultaneously the streamers have come in as well, and it feels like that way of piecing together international co-productions or just indie films to financing that way is just really, really, really hard. So we found it particularly difficult, particularly with this other film that we're trying to put together. We found it really hard to get enough money together to do it on a slightly higher budget than what we were working on before. And I think that's generally the case for independent producers here in the UK. I think it's become very difficult to get films financed if you're not connected to either distribution in the US or one of the streamers, where the streamers have sort of essentially created a market where they will buy out an entire budget or whatever up front, which is amazing if you can get that deal. But then once you go there and you pitch and they say no, that door's closed then for that project, and it's very difficult to find a different avenue, I think. So it's really challenging times, but at the same time, it's always been challenging anyway. Like, it's always been really, really difficult. So it's not that I think things are particularly bad in the sense that I have a pessimistic outlook. I just think you just have to be inventive and find other ways to do these things. And it's hard, but it's kind of always been hard, I think.
We're actually taking one of our own screenplays and we're turning it into a feature-length podcast as kind of a
Okay.
showcase. There's actually a little bit of a market now in the States for movie podcasts with all the sound effects and everything. It's kind of like going back to 1930s radio drama. And it's a way of just getting something out there with a little bit of sizzle to see maybe the movie would come along. Well, Matt, as a having been exposed to this for a while now, do you have directing ambitions yourself?
No, not really. I think I struggle enough with one job. I don't really want to have two,
Got it. Well, this has been very enjoyable for the listeners and viewers. The movie is called Toll Booth. And it's really a joy, and it has violence in it. I'm not going to tell you it's a sweet movie. There's definitely some violence in the movie, but the performances are really excellent, and the storyline is just a lot of fun. And I think it's worth checking it out. And it's pretty easy to find in the States in the streaming verse. You know, like everything, you just kind of have to just type it in and find it. This has been very enjoyable, Matt. You've been listening to and watching Saturday Night at the Movies. I'm your host, Steve Rubin. Our producer's Ben Shrewsbury. And we're working on a YouTube channel. We hope to have it up and operational soon. But our podcast is available on all the platforms, as you know. Thank you for listening. And thank you, Matt.
Thank you.